explained for the benefit of any of Seatrigger's Norsemen unfamiliar with the idea, is offered by the Church to criminals. So long as they remain here, we can't touch them without being criminals ourselves. I kicked the two men's swords towards Berg. If we assault them here, we'll be punished.
They won't dare punish me, Seatrigger said.
You haven't experienced the fury of the priests, I said. They preach peace and demand the death of their enemies. Besides, I want to release them.
Release them?
Seatrigger exclaimed. Someone has to give Lord Athelhelm the good news, I explained. Then I pushed Serpent Breath into a scabbard and turned back to the two men. Both were young. One had a bruise on his cheek and was shaking with fear. The other was surly and had the courage to face me boldly. I had been using Danish to talk to Seatrigger, but now used the Saxon tongue.
"Who are you?" I asked the surly man.
He hesitated, tempted to defiance, then decided sense was the better choice.
"Helmstan," he muttered.
I waited and saw the resentment in his eyes.
"Lord," he added, "who do you serve?"
Again the hesitation, and it was the second man, younger and more frightened, who stammered the answer.
"Grimbold, Lord."
"Grimbold," I repeated the name, which was unfamiliar to me. "And who does Grimbold serve?" I asked. Helmstan was scowling at his companion and said nothing, so I drew Waspsting, my short sword, and smiled at him. "This one hasn't drawn blood tonight, and she's thirsty." The priest started a protest, but went silent when I turned Waspsting's blade towards him.
"Who does Grimbold serve?" I asked again.
"Grimbold serves Lord Athelhelm, Lord,"
Helmstan said reluctantly. "Did Grimbold lead you tonight?"
"No, Lord."
"Who did?"
"Torthrid, Lord."
It was not a name I knew, and I assumed whoever Torthrid was, he was now dead in the street.
"Did Torthrid serve Grimbold?" I asked.
"Yes, Lord."
"And what were your orders tonight?" I asked.
Neither man answered, so I took a pace towards them and lifted Waspsting.
"They call me the Priest Killer," I said. "Do you think I care a rat's arse about sanctuary?"
"We were ordered to kill you, Lord."
The more frightened man whispered the words. He moaned when I placed Waspsting's blade on his bruised cheek. I left the blade there for a few heartbeats, then stepped back and sheathed the Saax.
"Tell Grimbold," I told both men, "that he has two new enemies, Uhtred of Bevanburg and Seatrigger of Northumbria. Now go."
They went. Chapter 8
"If we are to crush Skoll," Seatrigger told me the next morning, "we must have peace with Edward. I can fight one or the other, not both."
"Edward's ill," I said. "He won't fight."
"You're certain of that?"
Seatrigger challenged me. And all I could do was shrug.
"He might be ill," Seatrigger went on, "but his armies aren't."
He paused as Svart opened the tavern's shutters to let in sunlight. The rain had stopped. Seatrigger leaned forward to blow out a rushlight.
"If Edward can't lead his armies," he said gloomily, "his Eldermen can." "They're fighting like starving dogs over who inherits the throne."
"And the sure way to unite them," Seatrigger said, "is to give them a common enemy, me."
He speared a slab of bacon with his knife and stared at it moodily.
"Why does he want peace? Why doesn't he just invade?"
"Because his kingdom is a mess," I said. "The Mercians are still grumbling. The East Anglian Danes are restless. He's got a new wife with tits that smell of lavender, and he fears us."
"Fears us?"
"Suppose he invades," I suggested. "Suppose he marches an army north through Lincoln and we beat his bones to powder."
"Can we?"
he asked gloomily.
They'll outnumber us.
They're Saxons, Svart growled. Of course we can beat them.
He'll outnumber us, I allowed, but you know as well as I do that numbers aren't everything. He thinks he can beat us, but he isn't certain of it. I tore off a hunk of stale bread, decided I wasn't hungry, and threw it to one of the tavern's dogs. And remember, I went on, we're the dreaded Northmen. When I was a young man, we reckoned a Danish warrior was worth 3 Saxons.
4, Svart put in.
That didn't prove true, I said, earning a scowl from Svart, but the fear lingers. The Saxons think we're pagan savages, and they'd rather talk us into submission than fight us. They will fight us if they have to, but Edward fears defeat, because if we break his armies, then East Anglia revolts, the Mercians will demand their own king again, and the Wessex nobles will want a new king. Seatrigger smiled wanly.
Maybe we should just invade Mercia?
Beat the bastards. We do that, I said, knowing he was not serious, and Constantine of Scotland will stab us in the back. Seatrigger grunted. He was dressed for the Witan, wearing a robe of dark blue wool edged in cloth of gold. A simple crown, nothing more than a ring of gilt bronze, rested on a table beside his jug of ale.
"This ale tastes like cow piss," he grumbled. "You don't think I should make peace with Edward?"
"It depends on the price."
"I want Skoll dead," he said vengefully. "Killing that bastard is worth any price."
"Worth submission to Edward?" Seatrigger looked at me mournfully.
"I have little choice."
"Baptism?"
"I don't mind getting wet."
"Tribute?" He grinned.
"I'll equip a pair of ships and we'll go Viking. We'll raid a fat Wessex monastery and there's the tribute."
"And even if you do submit," I ignored his idea, "and make a treaty, the Saxons will break it as soon as they think it's safe to invade you." He nodded.
"But I'll still have time to kill Skoll first."
"Unless I reach him before you." He half smiled at that.
"What happens if I refuse to submit?"
"The Saxons will get braver and braver. They'll provoke you with cattle raids. They'll keep small armies on the border. They'll tax your trade more heavily. Their ships will capture your merchant ships, and in the end, they'll invade."
"So either way, we lose."
"Not if we build up our strength." He offered a mirthless laugh to that.
"And how do I do that?"
"We beat Skoll," I said firmly, "and we bind Cumberland to Northumbria. We force all those Norse bastards to swear loyalty to you. We make an army of Ulfhednar. We unite the Northmen and put the fear of the gods into the Saxons."
"I like that idea," Seatrigger said quietly.
If I had known the truth of what I had just said, I might have kept silent. Or perhaps not.
Weird bith full arad.
But at least Seatrigger saw some hope in those words. He traced a finger around his crown, thinking.
"And we can't subdue Cumberland unless we're at peace with Edward."
I nodded reluctantly.
"Yes, Lord King. We can't fight both at once."
He stood.
"Then let's go and grovel to the sick bastard."
And so we climbed the hill. We would grovel. We passed St. Aelfrith's Church, where we had cornered the 2 fugitives. The night's rain had washed the blood from the street, and the town reeve's men had removed the bodies. A bell was tolling from the hilltop, presumably to summon the Witan, but the steep track leading up to the high church and the palace was being guarded by spearmen who barred us from climbing the hill while a procession of horsemen passed by. There were 50 or 60 riders, all in mail, all with helmets, all carrying spears, and all going towards the palace, and at their centre was a small cart drawn by a pair of heavy horses. The cart, little more than a farm wagon, had been draped with dark blue cloth and furnished with cushions on which sat two women and a priest. One woman was old, the other young and long-faced, with a close-fitting bonnet that hid most of her dark hair. She was richly dressed in sombre grey and black, looked sad, and wore a large silver cross at her breast. The cart lurched alarmingly on the rough road, and the young woman clutched one of the side rails to steady herself.
"Who's that?" Seatrigger asked me.
"I don't know," I said, which was true. Yet the long, sad face was somehow familiar. She glanced at me and seemed to recognize me, then quickly looked away as the cart lurched again. She appeared to be holding back tears. The older woman had just put an arm around the younger's shoulders, while the priest was murmuring to her, presumably trying to comfort her.
"Damn, but she's ugly," Seatrigger said. "She looks like a horse."
"She's cold and unhappy," I said.
"So she looks like a cold and miserable horse."
We followed the cart and its escort up the hill, through the arch where our swords were taken from us, and so to the great hall where smoke from damp firewood swirled among the high rafters. The tables had been stacked to one side and the benches had been arranged in a half-circle around the big hearth to face the platform, where five high-backed chairs were draped with deep scarlet cloths. Close to 100 men had already arrived and were sitting as near to the fire as they could, though a few were standing and talking quietly. They looked at us as we entered, recognized us, and started whispering. To most of these men we were the strangest of creatures. Pagans, the dwellers of their bad dreams come to life.
"Where do we sit?" Seatrigger asked.
"We don't," I said, "not yet." The nobles of Edward's three kingdoms would occupy the benches, and to let Seatrigger sit with the eldermen, bishops, and abbots would be to diminish his status. I assumed the platform was for royalty, and though Seatrigger was undoubtedly royal, I did not want him to take one of the chairs and then be publicly ordered to leave it. He had attended a Witan before at Huntingdon, where he had sat on the dais with Edward, but on that occasion he had been a guest of Ethelfled, and she had possessed a courtesy her brother lacked. If Edward wanted the King of Northumbria in a place of honour, he would extend the invitation, and if not, then it was better that we should stand apart at the rear of the hall.
"You know what you're to say?"
I asked him.
"Of course I know. You've told me 10 times, 20 times."
He was nervous and irritable, and I could not blame him. He was being treated with disdain, humiliated by Saxons. More men were arriving in the hall, and I saw how they looked at Seatrigger with both curiosity and amusement. They had spent their whole existence in an unending war between the Christians and the pagans, and now the last pagan king was standing like a supplicant at the back of the king's hall. I saw Brunulf Torkelsen, a West Saxon whose life I had saved, enter through the great doors, and, leaving Seatrigger flanked by Finan and the enormous Svart, I crossed to Brunulf's side. He was carrying a spear and shield because he was one of the royal guards who would either line the hall's sides or else stand in front of the platform. He greeted me warmly.
"I heard you were here, Lord, and hoped to meet you."
He hesitated, then frowned.
"And I heard about your daughter. Lord, I am sorry."
"Fate is a bitch," I said, then fell silent as Æthelhelm the Younger strode through the doors, followed by a retinue of 12 men. He looked at me, seemed startled, and abruptly swerved to avoid passing near me. He wore the red cloak of his household troops, though his cloak had a fine colour of fur and was clasped with gold. He strode to the front of the hall, and men who had taken benches there hurriedly moved to let him sit.
"Do you know Grimbald?" I asked Brunulf.
"I know 3 men with that name," he said.
"A follower of Æthelhelm," I added. He turned and looked into the hall.
"There,"
he said, nodding towards the benches that Æthelhelm had taken.
The man wearing a fox fur cap.
I looked. The one with the flattened nose?
That's him,
Brunel said.
You heard his men got into a drunken brawl last night? 5 of them died.
Who were they fighting? Brunel looked at me suspiciously, but with a half-smile.
You mean you don't know, Lord?
Me? I asked. Fight? Whatever makes you think I'd be part of a drunken street brawl? I'm an elderman of Northumbria. I'm respectable.
Of course you are, Lord.
I left him by the door and pushed my way through the growing crowd to the front of the hall. Athelhelm saw me coming and turned to have an intense conversation with the stern-looking priest who sat beside him. Grimbald, sitting just a few paces away, began to stand, then realized he could not escape me, and sat again. I stopped right in front of him, and just looked down at him, saying nothing. He gazed at my belt buckle, a wolf's head cast in bronze. All around us men fell silent. I saw Grimbald tremble, so I smiled, bent down, and whispered in his ear, "You're a dead man." He did not move, just sat. I turned to Athelhelm and smiled at him, too. "Sometime," I said, "you really must visit Bevanburg and meet your nephew. He's a fine little boy. You know how I look forward to welcoming you." Athelhelm could not ignore me. He stood. He was a good-looking man, maybe 30 years old, with a narrow face and haughty eyes. A servant must have shaved him that morning, because there were 2 small razor nicks on his chin. There was gold at his neck, on his red cloak, and on his fingers. He took a step towards me, evidently eager for a confrontation, but just then a horn announced the arrival of King Edward, and the seated men in the great hall stood, snatched off their caps, and bowed towards the platform. The blaring horn forced Athelhelm to turn away from me and bow, though his bow was little more than a cursory nod. I neither bowed nor nodded, but just turned and walked back to see Trigger. "I just made someone wet himself," I said. See Trigger ignored the boast. "Is that a king?" he asked derisively. He was looking at the platform. I looked too, and was shocked. I had seen Edward the previous night, but he had been slumped on the table, his body cloaked, his face half hidden. But now, in the sunlight coming through the large eastern windows, I could see him far more clearly. He had become fat. He limped. His dark hair was lank and grey under the emerald-encrusted crown. His beard was grey, and his once handsome face was lined and blotched. He could not live long, I thought. And when he died, the cockfight for the crown would begin. I had thought the 5 chairs would be for Edward, his wife, Eadgifu, and his eldest son, Elfweird, with one of the others to be offered to see Trigger, but I was wrong. Queen Eadgifu and Prince Elfweird were indeed to sit at either side of the king, but the 2 outer chairs were reserved for the archbishops, who followed the royal family onto the platform, both men swathed in richly embroidered robes. I did not know the new Archbishop of Contwaraburg, Athelm, a West Saxon who had a lean, ascetic face and a beard long enough to hide the pectoral cross on his breast. He looked sternly into the hall before taking his seat, while Hrothweird of Eofowick smiled at the assembly, then waited for Eadgifu to take her seat before sitting himself.
"They brought their sorcerers," Seatrigger grumbled.
"They always do." I looked around the hall, searching for Æthelstan, but to my surprise he was nowhere to be seen. I assumed he reckoned his father would not welcome him, and so had stayed away. I leaned close to Seatrigger. "Grimbald is on the front bench," I whispered, "to the right of the hearth. He has a flattened nose and a fox fur cap." Seatrigger just nodded. The day's business began, as it always did at a Witten, with a prayer and then a sermon. Athelm preached, and I wandered into the courtyard rather than listen to his tedious harangue.
Seatrigger, Svart, and Finnan joined me, and we sat on the edge of a stone horse trough, and I stopped a passing servant and demanded ale. Seatrigger was apprehensive and sometimes paced the courtyard, watched by the royal guards who were posted all about the courtyard's edge. We must have waited for at least an hour before a nervous steward came into the sunlight and bowed to Seatrigger.
"Lord King, your presence is requested."
Seatrigger rammed his crown over his unruly fair hair.
"Shall we go?"
he asked.
"Home," Svart suggested.
"Into the hall," Seatrigger said grimly,
and went to learn his fate. We followed and stood at the back of the hall as Seatrigger, now escorted by two guards, walked through the benches, around the hearth, and took his place in front of the platform. Now, I thought, we would learn just what humiliation the Saxons would demand of him. Hrothweird, Archbishop of York, had been deputed to tell Seatrigger of Wessex's terms, and that, at least, showed some tact on Edward's part. Hrothweird knew Seatrigger well, and the two men respected and liked each other. Seatrigger ruled in a city that had far more Christians than pagans, and he had ever followed Hrothweird's advice on how to curb antagonisms between the two, while the Archbishop sternly demanded of his clergy that they did not preach hate against their fellow Northumbrians. Now Hrothweird smiled at Seatrigger.
"It is good to see you here, Lord King," he said.
He spoke in Danish, which surprised me. A monk, one of two sitting at a table at the side of the platform where they were busily writing what I supposed was a record of the Witan's deliberations, interpreted for the benefit of the hall.
"Louder!"
a man called from the benches, and the monk repeated his translation, and then, almost immediately, Æthelhelm stood.
"I have a protest, Lord King,"
Æthelhelm said loudly. Hrothweird, about to start reading from a parchment, paused. Edward, who looked thoroughly disgruntled with the proceedings, frowned at his richest nobleman.
"You wish to speak, Lord?"
he asked.
"I wish to speak, Lord King,"
Æthelhelm said. Edward paused, then nodded.
"We shall hear you, Lord," he said.
Æthelhelm turned to face the hall.
"I do not believe, Lord King,"
he spoke silkily,
"that Lord Uhtred of Bebbanburg was summoned to this assembly."
He turned back to Edward. "I demand he be removed." Æthelhelm's supporters, and that was at least half of the Witan, murmured their support, and the murmur grew louder until Edward held up a hand. Seatrigger spoke some English, but not well, and he looked bemused by the protest. Edward scowled at me.
"You were not summoned, Lord Uhtred,"
he said, plainly siding with his most powerful noble. I had anticipated and was ready for the challenge. I could not say that Æthelstan had invited me, because invitations to the Witan are issued by the king, not by his sons. So instead, respectfully, I claimed to have come as a witness.
"A witness?"
Edward seemed perplexed by the word. "As a witness for a petitioner, Lord King," I said. "And witnesses have always been allowed to attend Witan since at least your father's time."
"We have enough business today without hearing any petitions," Æthelhelm snarled.
"I believe that is for the king to decide,"
Archbishop Hrothweird intervened before Æthelhelm's supporters could make any noise.
"I'm sure my lord of Contwerriburg would agree with me."
Æthelhelm looked startled, tugged at his beard, then nodded.
"The king may allow whoever he wishes to attend,"
he muttered. And Eadgifu, looking resplendent in a gown of pale yellow silk, leaned and whispered in her husband's ear. Edward looked annoyed, but waved a hand towards me.
"You may remain, Lord Uhtred,"
he said,
"but only as a witness. You can say nothing of other matters."
I bowed. Æthelhelm sat, and Hrothweird looked down at Seatrigger, and, in English now,
read out the list of demands that Edward was making for a lasting treaty of peace between the Saxon kingdoms and Northumbria. The monk translated each demand, and Sigtryggr stood, tall and straight, suffering. The demands were mostly what we had expected. Svart, next to me, growled as they were revealed, but I could not share his indignation. The West Saxons, I knew, had no intention of keeping to the treaty. It bought them time, no more, and when they were ready they would tear up the parchment and send their warriors north. And if the West Saxons could ignore the terms, so could Sigtryggr. The treaty, Hrothweird declared, would usher in an era of lasting peace between the kingdoms. Swords, he declared grandly, would be beaten into ploughshares. Svart spat when that was translated. To bring that peace, the archbishop continued, it was necessary for Sigtryggr to acknowledge Edward as his overlord, to swear loyalty to him, and in reparation for the damages done by Northumbrian outlaws who had preyed on honest Christian folk in Mercia, silver weighing 3,000 pounds was to be paid into King Edward's treasury at Wintonchester before the Feast of Pentecost. There was an intake of breath at that vast sum, but Hrothweird was not finished. He spoke gently, knowing how his words must gall Sigtryggr, but the demands were anything but gentle. Sigtryggr must swear he would do all in his power to prevent cattle raids, and if any such raids took place, the King of Northumbria undertook to pay the full value of the stolen livestock to King Edward's treasury, and as much again to the folk whose cattle were stolen. Northumbrian merchants trading in Wessex, Mercia, or East Anglia were to pay a new tax, but no such levy was to be imposed on subjects of King Edward who traded in Northumbria. King Edward's troops could march through Northumbria without impedance. King Sigtryggr must agree to protect the lives and property of all Christian folk living in Northumbria. When he read that last demand, Hrothweird had the decency to lower the document and smile at Sigtryggr.
As I know you already do, Lord King.
There was a sharp gasp of surprise from the Witan at those last words, and one or two men looked ready to protest, but Hrothweird held up a hand to quell the unrest.
Further, he read, you are to allow Christian missionaries free passage and protection within the borders of your realm.
I was tempted to ask whether Wessex would allow men and women to travel its roads preaching the worship of Thor and Odin, but I had the sense to keep quiet. Sigtryggr was likewise silent, even though the terms being imposed on him were brutal, humiliating, and not negotiable.
And finally,
Hrothweird frowned slightly as he came to the end of the document,
we cannot rely upon the word of a pagan king, for it is well known in this kingdom and in all Christian kingdoms that pagans treat solemn promises with disdain, swearing their oaths on false gods and breaking such oaths with impunity.
I doubted Hrothweird had written the words, but Athelm of Contwaraburg was looking mightily pleased with himself. Edward just looked bored.
To make certain that Sigtryggr of Northumbria keeps to the terms of this treaty, Hrothweird continued, it is required that he undergo baptism this day and accept our Christian God in full faith as the one God, the only God, and the true God, and must understand that by acceptance he places his soul in jeopardy of hell's eternal torments if he breaks so much as one sentence of this treaty. He agrees, moreover, that he will extirpate the worship of false gods and foul idols from all his lands.
Finan nudged me. He means you, he muttered. Hrothweird waited as the monk translated his last words, then looked sympathetically at Sigtryggr.
"Do you accept the terms, Lord King?"
he asked. Sigtryggr paused long enough for the hall to become restless. Edward, surprised by Sigtryggr's silence, sat up straighter. Like everyone else in the hall, he had expected Seatrigger to meekly agree to whatever was demanded.
"Do you accept the terms, Lord King?"
Hrothweird asked again. Seatrigger answered directly to Edward, though his words needed to be interpreted by the monk.
"You say, Lord King, that you cannot trust the oath of a pagan?"
"That is true,"
Hrothweird answered for Edward.
"Yet it is the Christians who have broken their pledges,"
Seatrigger said forcefully. Uproar followed the translation of those words. Hrothweird called for silence, but it was Edward's frown and upraised hand that finally stilled the hall.
"How have Christians broken their pledges?"
he asked suspiciously.
"Was I not promised safe conduct if I agreed to attend this witten?"
Seatrigger demanded. There was an uncomfortable shuffling in the hall. Men started murmuring, but Archbishop Hrothweird raised his voice.
"You were indeed so promised, Lord King," he said loudly,
silencing the protests.
"Then how can I trust your words?"
Seatrigger was looking directly at Edward now, and repeating the words we had agreed.
"When only last night your men made an attack on my life."
The monk translated, and there was a roar of indignation from the hall's crowded benches, mainly, I thought, from those men who looked to Æthelhelm for leadership.
"I accuse Grimbald,"
Seatrigger had to shout to make himself heard. He waited for the noise to subside, then pointed at Grimbald.
"I accuse Grimbald," he said again. "I accuse him of breaking the king's peace, of attempting to murder me, of bad faith."
He looked back to Edward.
"Give me justice in this matter, Lord King, and I will accept all your terms. That is my petition, in which I bring Lord Uhtred of Bebbanburg as my witness."
There was renewed uproar, of course, but every man in the hall knew of the bodies discovered in the street of the metalworkers, knew there had been a fight by St. Aelfrith's church, and knew that Grimbald's men had taken a beating. Some few, those who were the closest allies of Æthelhelm, must also have known that no one had demanded Seatrigger's death, that the men had been sent to kill me instead, but that was hardly a defence for Grimbald, who, summoned to answer the accusation, stammered that his men had acted on their own, that he knew nothing of the night's events, and that he was not responsible for what drunken men did in the middle of an ale-steeped night.
"Two men returned to me," Grimbald said desperately, "and I will punish them, Lord King."
"Yet they confessed they acted on your orders," Seatrigger pressed his advantage. "And in witness of their confession I bring Lord Uhtred."
The mention of my name was sufficient to start another commotion, loud enough to startle the sparrows perched on the rafters, who flew about in panic. Beneath them, men were standing and shouting, most of them, it seemed to me, supporting Grimbald's claim that he knew nothing of the nighttime brawl, but some, more than a few, shouted that I should be allowed to speak. Edward again held up a hand for silence, while Archbishop Hrothweird thumped his silver-topped crozier on the platform's boards.
"Lord Uhtred,"
Hrothweird called down the length of the hall when at last he could be heard,
"are King Seatrigger's words true?"
A few men started to protest, but were hushed by others who wanted to hear me.
"They are true," I said to Hrothweird, "but you would expect me to say that. However, I am willing to bring the priest of St. Aelfrith's church to this assembly. He, too, heard the men say they were sent by Grimbald."
Bringing the priest to the witten was a risk, of course. The man might lie, and even if he spoke the truth, he could not testify that the men were sent to kill Seatrigger. I had thought to keep one of the two men we had captured and threaten him with dire pain if he did not tell the truth. But again, the truth would not reveal a plot against Seatrigger, and the man would most likely deny any plot at all, knowing his dishonesty would be rewarded by Grimbald and by Æthelhelm.
Yet, by offering a Christian priest as a witness, I knew I'd thwarted Grimbald's lies, so long as the priest was not fetched from the lower town, and that, I thought, was most unlikely, because King Edward and the two archbishops wanted this tedious Witten over and done. The men in the hall simply assumed the priest would support Seatrigger's account and so would not need to be summoned, and that assumption proved to be true. There was an anxious silence from Athelhelm's supporters as Hrothweird stooped to speak with Edward, who could hardly hide his impatience. Archbishop Athelm leaned across the moon-faced Elfweird to add yet more advice, and Edward, who looked ever more unhappy, finally nodded. Edward pointed at Grimbald.
"I offered King Seatrigger safe passage," the king said, his voice sullen, "and by breaking my peace you have forfeited your life."
There was a gasp at that. Grimbald, still standing, opened his mouth as if to speak, found he had no words, and looked at Athelhelm, who ostentatiously turned his back on the doomed man.
"Lord!"
Grimbald at last found his voice, but by then two royal guards had taken his arms and he was being escorted from the hall. Athelhelm did not turn to watch. Everyone present, the king included, knew Grimbald must have acted on Athelhelm's orders, yet Athelhelm did nothing to save Grimbald's life. The king could have saved him, but Edward wanted to see Seatrigger on his knees. He wanted the peace treaty. He was greedy for the treaty's silver. And one Saxon life was a small price to pay for that triumph. Men muttered bitterly as Grimbald left, while Athelhelm just stared bleakly into the flames of the hearth. That one Saxon life was our sole victory of the day. I thought Seatrigger's ordeal was over, all but for the misery of being baptized. Yet when Grimbald was gone to his death, Edward struggled to his feet and held out a hand for silence. He looked tired and ill, and I wondered what had happened to the young man I had known, and thought how swiftly he had decayed into this heavy, sullen greybeard.
"It is our pleasure," he said tonelessly, "to seal this treaty by marriage, to bind Northumbria to our royal house with bonds of blood."
He stopped abruptly, evidently out of words, and just sat. And I could do nothing but stare at him in amazement. Marriage? No one had spoken of marriage, and the ashes of Seatrigger's queen, my daughter, were scarce cold, yet Edward was offering a bride. Then there was a stir at the door, spearmen marched in, and behind them came Æthelstan, and on his arm was the girl we had seen on the cart. I recognized her then. She was Eadgith, Æthelstan's twin, whom I had last known as a child. She walked with a straight back, head held high, but her pale face was a mask of misery. Seatrigger was wrong, I thought. She was not ugly. Her long face, like Æthelstan's, was strong, and her eyes piercing, but her unhappiness and the grim set of her thin lips made her look plain. Æthelstan stopped with his sister a few paces short of the rearmost bench, evidently waiting for a summons.
"It is our joy,"
Hrothweird spoke again to Seatrigger,
"and in the knowledge of your queen's sad death, to offer you as a bride the Lady Eadgith, the beloved daughter of Edward, Anglorum Saxonum Rex."
And with that, Æthelstan walked Eadgith forward through the benches of watching men who, I think, were as surprised as I was. Eadgith was to be a peace cow, a bride to seal a treaty, and I saw Seatrigger's shock as he began to understand what was happening to him. But I doubted he understood the implied insult in this offer of a West Saxon bride. Edward was giving him his eldest daughter, but she was a daughter whom most men in Wessex considered illegitimate. Hrothweird had acknowledged her as Edward's child. He had even called her beloved, which was stretching the meaning of love. But he had deliberately not called her a princess. And she was old for marriage, too. Very old,
at least in her middle 20s. A bastard royal, an unwanted girl, an inconvenience. And she had been fetched from whatever nunnery had presumably sheltered her, to marry a Northumbrian king, whom everyone in the hall knew must eventually be slaughtered by Saxon swords. No wonder so many men smirked, and even laughed as Eadgith walked towards her doom. But Eadgith would become a queen. Seatrigger would swear fealty. The priests would baptize him before they harnessed him to his peace cow, and Northumbria was humbled. And all Northumbria had to show for the treaty was an unwanted woman and Grimbald's bald head that was impaled on a spear blade and displayed in the palace courtyard. And Edward had his peace treaty. Seatrigger was baptized that afternoon and married 2 hours later. Both ceremonies took place in Tamworthin's high church, so that as many folk as possible could see his humiliation. Ethelfled had built the church, and I remember grousing to her that she would have been better off spending the silver on spears and shields, an argument I inevitably lost. And now, under a clear spring sky, the big church was packed to watch Seatrigger. He was dressed in a white penitent's robe, and ordered to climb into a great barrel filled with water from the River Tame, though Archbishop Hrothweird, who insisted on conducting the baptism, added water from a small jar. "This water," he declared, "was brought all the way from the River Jordan, the same river in which our Lord was baptized." I wondered how much he had paid for the stoppered jar, which, I suspected, had been filled from some monastery's scum-covered fish pond. Seatrigger, who had taken the precaution of giving me his hammer amulet for safekeeping, looked bemused throughout the ceremony, and good-naturedly allowed his head to be pushed under water as a choir chanted and as Hrothweird prayed. Afterwards he was presented with a silver cross, which he dutifully hung about his neck. He was still wearing the cross when he married Eadgith, though now he also wore his crown and a dark scarlet robe trimmed with fur, which was a gift from Prince Ethelstan. After the wedding, Seatrigger and his bride were conducted to a chamber in the palace, and that was the last I saw of him that day. Next morning I sent to the far steading where my men had waited, and by midday we were all on the road north. Seatrigger took back his hammer and ostentatiously hung it about his neck. The silver cross was nowhere to be seen. "I trust you had a good night, Lord King?" I asked him mischievously. "I slept badly," he grunted. "Badly? The miserable bitch was in tears all night." "Tears of joy, I'm sure," Seatrigger scowled at me. "She's still a virgin." "Still? Still." I stopped teasing him. "I knew her when she was a child," I said, "and she was clever then, and I'm sure she's clever still. She'll give you good counsel." He growled at that. "Damn her counsel, I'd rather she gave me a dowry." "There's no dowry." "She said I'd been given the best dowry of all, the gift of eternal life." "Pious bitch." The pious bitch was mounted on a white gilding, a present from her twin brother. She looked uncomfortable, even though her maid had padded the saddle with a thick woolen cloth. She was flanked by two priests. One, Father Eadsig, was a confessor. He was a small, worried-looking young man who kept glancing nervously at the warriors who surrounded him, while the other, Father Amandus, was a Danish convert who had been appointed as Seatrigger's chaplain, a job that could have explained his scowling face. I let Tintrig slow, then spurred him between Eadgith and her confessor. "My lady," I greeted her. She offered me a sad smile.
"Lord Uhtred?"
"It's been many years, my lady," I said, ignoring Father Amandus's disapproving look. "You used to play on my estate in Fagranforda." Fagranforda had been my largest Mercian estate, now in the hands of the leprous Bishop Wolford, who was said to be close to death, which was bad news for the brothels of Hereford.
"I remember Fagranforda," Eadgith said. You were always kind to us there. Does Father Cuthbert still live?
He does, my lady, though he's blind and old now. But still hail. He'll be glad to meet you again if you should come to Bebbanburg.
Who is Father Cuthbert?
The Danish priest asked suspiciously. He is the priest at Bebbanburg, I answered levelly. Half my men are Christians, and they need a priest. I saw the surprise on Father Amandus's face, but he said nothing. He's also the man who married Queen Edgith's parents, I went on, and has been forced to shelter from his enemies ever since. Father Amandus gave me a sharp look. He plainly knew the rumour that Ethelstan and Edgith were bastards.
Enemies?
He asked. Enemies, Lord, I corrected him, and waited.
Lord,
he said reluctantly. If Ethelstan is the eldest legitimate son, I said, then he has the best claim to succeed his father. Other men would prefer Elfweird, and those men would also prefer it if Father Cuthbert were dead. They want no living witnesses to Prince Ethelstan's legitimacy.
And who would you prefer?
Father Amandus asked, then remembered to add,
Lord?
Elfweird, I said.
You want Elfweird?
He sounded surprised. Elfweird, I said, is a miserable arsling. His name ought to be Elfturd, but if it comes to war between Wessex and Northumbria, which it will, I would rather face an army led by the arsling than an army led by Prince Ethelstan. Edgith frowned. She was wearing a close-fitting hood which gave her the appearance of a nun.
You would fight against my brother?
She asked sternly. Only if he invades my country, I said. And your country too now, my lady. She stared ahead at Sigtryggr.
I suppose it is, she said distantly.
We rode in silence for a while. Two swans beat overhead, going west, and I wondered what that omen meant. Edgith's eyes glittered with unshed tears.
He's a good man, my lady, I said quietly. Is he?
I doubt he wanted to marry any more than you did. He's confused and angry.
Angry?
She asked. Why? Then she stopped abruptly and made the sign of the cross.
Of course. Forgive me. I am sorry about Stiora, Lord Uhtred.
She looked at me and a tear ran down her cheek.
I should have spoken earlier. She was always kind to me as a child.
I did not want to talk about Stiora, so changed the subject. When did you learn you were to marry Sigtryggr? She seemed startled by the sudden question, then looked indignant.
It was just last week, she said,
and for the first time since I had greeted her, she showed some animation.
I had no warning. They came to the convent, summoned me from prayers, took me to London, gave me clothes and hurried me north.
She told me more of that week, and I half listened and half tried to comprehend why Edward had been in such haste.
They never asked whether it was what I wanted.
Edgith finished bitterly. You're a woman, I said dryly. Why would they ask you? She gave me a look that might have stunned an ox, then gave a mirthless laugh.
You would have asked, wouldn't you?
Probably, but I've never known how to handle women, I answered her still dryly. Did your father say why he wanted you to marry King Sigtryggr?
To make peace,
she said bleakly. And there will be peace, I said, of sorts. Sigtryggr will not break the treaty. He won't attack south, but the Saxons will come north.
King Edward will not break his word,
Father Amandus said sternly, and again remembered to add,
Lord?
Maybe not, I said, but do you think his successor will be bound by the treaty? Neither had an answer to that. The ambition of Wessex, my lady, is to make one kingdom of all the folk who speak English.
Amen,
Father Edsig said. I ignored him. And you, my lady, are now queen of the last country that speaks English and is not ruled by your father.
Then why marry me to Sigtryggr?
To lull us, to make us feel safe. You fatten the goose before you kill it. The Danish priest growled at that, but had the sense to say nothing.
And just then Rorik rode up from the rear of our long column, bringing Beedwulf and Winfled with him. I had told him to fetch the squirrel, but Brother Beedwulf had evidently decided to come too. I stretched back and caught hold of Winfled's bridle, and drew her mare up between me and Eadgith. "This, my lady, is Winfled. She is a Christian, a Saxon, and I would urge you to take her into your service. She's a good girl." Eadgith half-smiled at the squirrel. "Of course." I let go of Winfled's horse so that she fell behind again. "Thank you, my lady," I said to Eadgith. "You're going to discover, my lady, that Jofawick is mostly a Christian city."
"Mostly," Father Amandus said snidely.
Eadgith nodded.
"Archbishop Hrothweird told me the same. He seems a good man."
"A very good man," I said. "And so is your husband. He looks formidable, I know, but he's a kind man."
"I pray so, Lord Uhtred."
"Kindness," Father Amandus said, "is no substitute for godliness. King Sitruga must learn to love the faith."
A pause.
"Lord."
"King Sitruga," I told him sternly, "has no time to learn anything. He's going to war."
"War?"
He sounded shocked. "There is a man we have to kill." Eadgith was a peace cow, and she was discovering that the rivalry of nations is difficult. Religion, because of the hatreds it engenders, is difficult. Families, because of the spite they encourage, are difficult. Eadgith, Edward, Eadgifu, Æthelstan, Elfweird, and Æthelhel made a tangle of love, loyalties, and hate. Mostly hate. And that was difficult. The only thing that was simple was war. And Seatrigger and I were going to war. War is not easy. Simple, usually, but never easy. Dealing with Edward's ambitions was like groping for eels in the dark, and I wondered if even he knew who he really wanted to succeed him. Or perhaps he did not care, because to think of the succession was to contemplate his own death, and none of us enjoy that prospect. As a young man, Edward had shown promise, but wine, ale, and women had proved more appealing than the dull business of government, and he had grown fat, lazy, and sickly. In some ways, though, he had been a success, achieving what his more celebrated father had failed to. Edward had waged a campaign that had brought all of East Anglia under West Saxon rule, while his sister's death had given him the chance to include Mercia in his kingdom, though Mercia was still unsure whether that was a blessing or a curse. During Edward's reign, much of his father's dream had come true, the dream of a united England, and that dream told me that the treaty we had just agreed was not worth a sparrow's fart. The West Saxons, for it was the West Saxons who were creating England, would never abandon their ambition to swallow Northumbria. That was simple. And being simple, it would mean war.
"Not necessarily,"
Æthelstan had told me on the night after his sister's wedding. I scoffed at that. "You think we'll just surrender Northumbria?
You have a Saxon queen now."
"And my grandson," I had pointed out, "is Seatrigger's heir." He had frowned at that truth. We had met in the palace, in a small room adjoining the royal chapel. He had asked me to come, even sending men to escort me through Tamworthin's streets in case Æthelhel made another attempt on my life. I had gone reluctantly. Eadgifu had already tried to recruit my support for her infant sons, and I suspected Æthelstan also wanted my loyalty, so I had greeted him with surly words. "If you wanted me at the Witten so you could receive my oath," I told him, "you won't get it."
"Sit, Lord," he had said patiently. "There's wine."
I had sat, and he had then stood and paced the small room. We were alone. He fingered the cross about his neck, gazed at a leather wall hanging that showed sinners tumbling to hell's fires, and finally turned to me.
"Should I be king of Wessex?"
"Of course," I had answered without hesitation. "So you'll support me?" "No,"
Why not?
Because I'd rather fight Elfweird. He had grimaced at that, then paced the room again.
My father will leave me in Chester.
Good.
Why is that good?
It's harder for Athelhelm to kill you there.
I can't shelter behind walls forever.
You won't, I said.
No?
When your father dies, I'd suggested, you ride south with the men of Mercia and you claim the West Saxon throne.
And fight Athelhelm's forces?
If you need to, yes.
I will,
he had said forcefully.
And you won't help me.
I'm an Northumbrian. I'm your enemy. He half smiled.
How can you be my enemy? Your queen is my sister.
True, I conceded the point.
Besides, you're my friend.
He had stopped by a table on which stood a plain wooden cross flanked by candles. He reached out and touched the cross.
I do want an oath from you, he said.
He had not looked at me as he spoke, but gazed at the cross. He had waited for my response, but I said nothing, and my obstinate silence made him turn to me.
Swear on whatever god you believe in, he had said, that you will do all that you can to kill Elderman Athelhelm. Do that, and I will swear you an oath.
I had stared at him in surprise. His face, so strong and hard, was shadowed, but his eyes glittered with a trace of reflected candlelight.
"You would give me an oath?" I asked.
He was clutching his cross, perhaps to convince me of his earnestness.
"I asked you to come here so I could swear you an oath. An oath that promises that I will never fight against you, and that I will never invade Northumbria."
I hesitated, looking for whatever trap that promised oath concealed. Oaths bind us, and are not to be taken lightly.
"You can kill Athelhelm yourself," I said. "If I can," he said, "I will, but he's your enemy too."
"And by taking your oath," I'd said, "you promise not to invade Northumbria?"
"Not while you live."
"But you'd fight my son," I asked, "or my grandson."
"They must make their own agreements with me,"
he had said stiffly, meaning that Northumbria would be invaded when I died, and that, I thought ruefully, could not be many years away. On the other hand, if Æthelstan did become king, then the oath he promised would give Seatrigger and me time to build up Northumbria's strength. "What happens if your father orders you to invade Northumbria while I'm alive?" I had asked him.
"Then I will refuse. I will become a lay brother in a monastery if I need to. If I swear the oath to you, then I shall keep it."
He would, too, I thought. I had watched the nearest candle gutter, its smoke curling towards the ceiling.
"I can't kill Athelhelm while your father's alive," I said. "That would be cause for war."
Then another thought occurred to me, and I looked at him sharply.
"Are you asking me to kill him just to keep your conscience clear?"
He had shaken his head.
"I'm offering you what you want, Lord. Athelhelm has tried to kill both of us, so let's be allies in his death."
"I thought you Christians prefer to settle your arguments without killing." That had made him frown.
"Do you think I pursue his death lightly? So long as he lives, there cannot be peace in Wessex. If I succeed to the throne, he will rebel against me. He wants his nephew on the throne, and he will stop at nothing to achieve that."
"Or he wants the throne for himself," I said.
"There are some who believe that, yes,"
he had answered guardedly. "And by killing him," I said, "I make you king." He had bridled at that, suspecting I was accusing him of an unworthy ambition.
"Do you think I haven't prayed about that fate?"
he asked sternly.
"That I haven't struggled with my conscience? That I haven't spoken with Archbishop Athelm?"
And that was interesting, I had thought. It suggested that the new Archbishop of Contwaraburg was opposed to Athelhelm, or was at least a supporter of Æthelstan.
"Kingship is a burden," Æthelstan had continued, and I had seen he was entirely serious. "And I am convinced I am best capable of bearing that burden."